Yeah, it has been a very difficult year for me because in February of this year, the Department of Justice filed a petition before the Regional Trial Court to proscribe the Communist Party of the Philippines and the New People's Army as a terrorist organization. But when they submitted that petition, they have a list of 656 people. And I'm included in that list. And of course, that creates a lot of problems for indigenous. There are around 30 indigenous persons in that list. And it's very serious in terms of security risks, you know, in a situation in my country where extrajudicial killings are happening against so-called drug addicts, you know, and then you have a list of so-called alleged terrorists. Then what will prevent anybody from going to shoot or arrest the people in that list? So that's the situation that I find myself in right now.
Veteran activist Victoria Tauli Corpus, who helps the UN ensure that the rights of indigenous people worldwide are upheld, now finds herself in the fight of her life. Ms. Tauli Corpus has been an advocate for justice ever since she left her home in the mountains of the northern Philippines to attend high school in the capital, Manila. That was in the 1960s, the height of the Vietnam War, an era that sparked her awareness about discrimination against indigenous people. More than five decades later, Ms. Tauli Corpus is still fighting for other indigenous people in her role as a UN human rights expert, but also for herself. I'm Deanne Penn at the United Nations in New York. Welcome to UN Gender Focus, a podcast by the team here at UN News. I caught up with Ms. Tauli Corpus on the final day of the annual UN meeting on indigenous issues, which this time around had the collective rights to lands, territories, and resources as its theme. Later on, we'll hear more about the charges Ms. Tauli Corpus is facing. But first, let's meet her.
I'm Victoria Tauli Corpus. I am the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and I am a Kankanae Igorot from the Cordillera region in the Philippines.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tauli Corpus. And tell us about the Kankanae Igorot people from the Philippines.
Well, we have maybe less than a million people, but we are the ones who are the dominant population in the Cordillera region. We are one of those indigenous peoples who have resisted Spanish colonization. So we maintained a lot of the pre-colonial cultures and governance systems, unlike the dominant population, which have been assimilated into the Spanish rule. We were colonized for 350 years by the Spaniards.
And the Cordillera region is where in the Philippines?
It's in the north. It's in the northern Luzon, in the Big Island. It's almost near Taiwan.
Do you have a language there, or do you all speak in English or Tagalog? Or?
No, we have our own Kankanae dialect, our language, and then we have a lingua franca among us because we have many different languages. So we have the dominant language of Ilocano, which is like the language, and then we speak Tagalog as well. So we speak three languages at the same time.
Thank you. And of course, we're radio, but people cannot see what you're wearing. But I wonder if you can just describe. Yeah. You have on a jacket with this particular beading on it.
Yeah. Well, our people are craftspersons. You know, we weave our traditional skirts since even before the colonizers came. So we have our own weaving system, and we do a lot of beading. So most of my clothes are really handwoven. Usually it has this different colors. The dominant color usually is red, you know, and yellow and green. But this one is a combination of blue, green, and violet. You know, these are the more modern versions. But it also has all these beads, you know, which are done by our own women.
Thank you. And you're the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples for the United Nations. But you're a longtime activist,
yes.
Right? Tell me, how did you become involved in indigenous rights activism?
Yeah. Well, when I was, I think, 12, I passed a scholarship to go to Manila, to one of the schools, the Philippine Science High School. And at that time, that was in the 1966, no, and that was the height of the anti-Vietnam War protests, because that was the Philippines was used as a springboard of the planes that go to Vietnam and, you know, bomb the communities there. So we became aware about this situation. But at that same period, after, you know, in 1972, martial law was declared, and our communities were targeted for logging concessions, as well as for a big dam project which was funded by the World Bank. And that made me aware that as indigenous peoples, we have distinct problems compared to the general population, because our communities are considered like resource-based to extract resources, to extract the, you know, to dam the rivers. But we don't receive a lot of government services. So I realized that we do experience discrimination, and we are not even asked whether these projects are acceptable by us. And that made me realize that we have to fight back. And so I joined the movement to fight back against the dams, the logging concessions. And that's how I became an activist. And then we learned about the UN, the UN Declaration on Human Rights, because many of our people were being arrested, tortured, you know, some were killed. So we didn't know where to go because it was martial law. There was no, the justice system was totally controlled by the Marcos regime. So then that's how we started coming to the United Nations, and that's when I joined the processes of drafting the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
And it's so interesting that you became an activist due to land rights issues in your country, the Philippines. Yeah. And this time, the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is looking at land.
Exactly. Yes, it's very good. And in fact, I'm so happy that that this was the theme now. Because when I was still the chair of the forum, we also had land, territories, and resources as the theme. But, you know, if the situation now has changed in even worse ways, because there's a lot of criminalization of indigenous peoples who are fighting to protect their lands and territories and resources. And that kind of phenomenon wasn't that grave during the time that we discussed this issue. No, and now the activists who are fighting for their land rights and their rights, of course, are being charged with criminal cases. And that is really a phenomenon that I hope the forum will look into and make some recommendations on.
And I wonder if you can tell us, I mean, Indigenous people, from my understanding, you have a particular relationship with land and territory, right? What is it for you?
Well, for me, it's, of course, we are the ones who have lived in our territory since time immemorial. We still remain there, you know, that's still our territory. And we are still in control in the Philippines because we are the dominant, we are the majority in in the Cordillera, no? So we have an Indigenous People's Rights Act that we fought for, which recognizes our rights to our lands, territories, and resources. So for me, it's an acknowledgement, you know, of the rights that we have been fighting for a long time. But we still have to be very vigilant because even if we have the law and we are given like certificates of ancestral domain titles, that doesn't guarantee that we can keep the lands, you know, in the ways we would like it to be. So because we want to maintain the land in its, you know, the ecosystem in the most robust ways and to decide on how our land should be used. And we have a lot of spiritual and cultural relationship with the land. You know, many of our rituals are related to the agricultural cycle. So before we plant rice, when we harvest, when we clean the fields, we have rituals which are community rituals, and we give our thanks to the deities, our ancestors, you know. So it's a very it's a relationship that really totally captures the collective attachment that we have to our lands.
And as UN Special Rapporteur, you travel to different countries and meet with Indigenous people. Mm. Are they also experiencing the same things in terms of land ownership?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. You know, I have been, since I became the rapporteur in 2014, I have visited Paraguay, Brazil, Honduras, Mexico, the U.S. as well, and Australia, you know. And I've seen that was the main, one of the key issues of the Indigenous peoples in those countries. You know, Brazil, for instance, now is now undermining, you know, dismantling some of the laws that they have that respect the rights of Indigenous people. So there's a lot of encroachment by agricultural monoculture plantations, you know, for soya, for sugarcane, into Indigenous people's lands. And these are even affecting Indigenous people's involuntary isolation. You know, infrastructure projects like hydroelectric dams are also put in their lands or highways without getting their consent or even consulting with them. So it's a similar problem in many places, you know, even in the United States. I went to the Standing Rock Sioux, you know, last year. That was the official visit that I had. I went to North Dakota, and I've seen the way that the oil extractive industry has really destroyed and polluted many of their lands.
Why is this still happening? I mean,
well, I think one of the reasons is the world, I mean, many governments in general still believe that extracting the resources, you know, as best as they can. It's the thing for them to do to be able to generate gross national product, you know, to generate income. And they haven't really gone through, you know, rethinking how what kind of development should happen so that there will be a balance between, you know, development, environment, you know, and cultural, social development. And that's precisely what the Sustainable Development Goals is trying to achieve. You know, and I think there has to be a serious rethinking of how we do development. Because, for instance, mineral extraction, you know, why do you keep on extracting minerals when you can recycle many of this aluminum? For instance, there's a lot of aluminum in the world, and this can be recycled so that you don't go in and mine bauxite. You know, the same with coal. I mean, we now have a lot of renewable energy, you know, projects which do not have to use coal. You use the sun, the wind, the tide, you know, and I think that's really the challenge for the world today. How are we going to shift away from using resources which are non-renewable and which are going to cause a lot of pollution, and move away and go towards a more sustainable way of using these resources? That's a problem, I think. And indigenous peoples, because we have been fighting very strongly to protect our lands, many of the last remaining resources in the world today are found in indigenous territories. And that's the reason why there's a lot of militarization and violation of rights of indigenous peoples to their lands and territories. It's like we are being punished for keeping these resources on the ground and in the forest. And now we are the ones suffering the most.
But are indigenous voices being heard? Because here at the Forum, which is annually at the United Nations, we see indigenous people from all parts, from the Arctic, the Sami, to your people, to people from Africa.
Yeah. Well, to a certain extent, these spaces which have been carved out for indigenous peoples to come and talk about their issues are providing more visibility to the indigenous people's issues. And of course, there's some, you know, I mean, in my mandate as the UN Special Rapporteur, I go to the countries, I make recommendations. And in some cases, some of my recommendations are also implemented. So to a certain extent, it gives a little hope to indigenous peoples, because there are these global spaces which are being used, and that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is being pushed to be implemented by the governments and also by the corporations. So to a certain extent, there is some, you know, there is there are spaces where we can be heard. What is needed is really more political will in terms of from the side of governments and corporations to respect these instruments and the, you know, the legally binding conventions that protects our right.
And speaking of governments, you talked earlier about your people in the Philippines, in the Cordillera region, and the issues you've had in the past. What is the situation today?
Well, we are not, I mean, we have been able to resist a lot of these incursions into our communities. Like in my town, which is called Bisao Mountain, it's in a mountain province, our elders and even the government has refused to have mining happen in our communities. Newmont, Newcrest, these are the big mining companies, went, explored, and they saw that we have high-grade gold ores. And the people decided, no, we will not allow that to happen, you know. So at least in my province, you know, we don't have these huge mining companies, you know. So because we are also the dominant population, we are able to assert our rights. But that's not the case with other indigenous peoples in the country. You know, in Mindanao, there's a lot of mining happening, and that's where a lot of militarization is also taking place, and people are also being displaced. There's a lot of internally displaced peoples because of mining operations and all these logging concessions as well.
But speaking about the relationship with the Philippines government, it's been a bit fractious, hasn't it? This has been a difficult year for you.
Yeah, it has been a very difficult year for me because, you know, the Philippine government in February of this year, the Department of Justice filed a petition before the Regional Trial Court to proscribe the Communist Party of the Philippines and the New People's Army as a terrorist organization. But when they submitted that petition, they have a list of 656 people, and I'm included in that list. No, so I immediately protested, saying that, you know, this is done in retaliation against the statements I made condemning the displacement and the extrajudicial killings happening in Mindanao, you know, against indigenous peoples. And of course, that creates a lot of problems for indigenous. There are around 30 indigenous persons in that list, and it's very serious in terms of security risks. You know, in a situation in my country where extrajudicial killings are happening against so-called drug addicts, you know, and then you have a list of so-called alleged terrorists, then what will prevent anybody from going to shoot or arrest the people in that list? So that's the situation that I find myself in right now. And of course, the UN, to its credit, have spoken very strongly. The High Commissioner on Human Rights says that I have immunity and privileges under the Convention of Privileges and Immunity of the United Nations. But still, the government says that I'm not there because I'm the rapporteur. I am there because of my association / membership with these two organizations. You know, so I'm protesting strongly. I'm demanding that the whole list be removed or the petition be withdrawn, because it's creating a lot of insecurity for the people who are included in that list.
And in addition to protesting, are you fighting it legally?
Yes. My lawyers in the Philippines have filed are filing a motion to get clarification on what is my status as far as that list is concerned. Am I a respondent? You know, just to get more clarity on why am I included in that list. And then, of course, we will be filing petitions on the, you know, writ of amparo and writ of habeas data, which means we would like to get all the data that they have on me, because they are saying that I have the opportunity to in fact, they said that here in the permanent forum when I was reporting under the human rights agenda, and the Philippine government spoke. I mean, said, I have the opportunity to defend myself. And, you know, I said, they are the ones accusing me. Why should I have the burden of proof? You know, and that by saying that mere association, I mean, will include you in that list. Well, how will I do my mandate as a rapporteur if groups that I speak with are branded as alleged terrorists? You know, many indigenous organizations in different parts of the world are also branded as such, you know.
You've been an activist for a long time. Is this the first time, or is this the most serious that it's got for you?
Well, no. When I was still doing my community organizing, I have established community-based health programs in the communities in the Cordillera. My house was raided by that was during martial law, 1980. No? My house was raided by the military, but that was fine because we managed to get them not to charge us anything. But this is the most serious one that I have had so far, you know. So, especially because I'm the UN Special Rapporteur, you know, and I do a lot of work, you know, on this particular issue. So, of course, it affects the work that I'll be doing, particularly in the Philippines, not for the whole the rest of the world, you know, but for the Philippines, it really is going to affect the way that I'm helping protect the rights of indigenous peoples.
And terrorism, I mean, it's a serious charge.
Yeah, it's a serious charge because we have a National Security Act, which says that if you are charged on that basis, under that act, it's non-bailable. You will be in prison for at least 7 years. So it's dangerous, you know. Of course, we are not yet at that stage, you know, but who knows where this is going to lead to if they are successful in labeling and proscribing the Communist Party as a terrorist organization. The implications is that all those people in the list will have to go to court to defend themselves, you know. And that is, as I said, in a situation where killings are happening right and left, you know, you really are at a very, very bad situation.
Ms. Tali Coppers, are you afraid?
Of course I'm afraid. You know, I'm afraid. In fact, it's a good thing that I'm now traveling because of all these meetings that I need to attend to. So even I'm afraid for myself. I'm afraid for my family. I'm also afraid for all the people in the list. You know, what future will they have, and how will they pursue their work as indigenous people's rights defenders? You know, so I'm afraid. But I'm also, on the other hand, I'm also glad that there is a lot of international, you know, reaction against it. You know, the High Commissioner spoke, even the Assistant Secretary General in the session condemned my vilification as a so-called terrorist. So that is giving me at least some comfort that people are concerned and they are going to speak, you know. And the Philippines, I also have a lot of support from some people. So in a way, it's great. But it's still scary.
You mentioned the Assistant Secretary General. You mean for Human Rights?
Yes. UN. Okay, Mr. Andrew Gilmore, when he spoke in the panel where I was, when I was reporting, he said clearly that he is totally against the vilification of myself, and especially because I'm the UN Special Rapporteur, and I enjoy the immunities against cases and against arrest, etc. So I'm glad that he said that in that session.
So that's interesting, because you are the special rapporteur defending the rights of indigenous
exactly.
people, and you, you've got someone defending.
Exactly. You know, I mean, usually it's like they have to defend people I'm speaking to, because sometimes they get reprisals. But in this particular case, it's the one defending. And of course, I cannot also defend the people now, because I'm in that particular situation as well. I mean, ideally, I should be speaking out against the inclusion of all those indigenous peoples in the list. But now I'm in the list, so... So it's ridiculous. It's really something that is unacceptable. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, let's see how it works. I hope that they will withdraw the petition, number one, or at least remove the list of people. And I mean, this has nothing to do with the petition, you know. Why do you include a list of people if not to threaten them, to persecute them, to stop them from being critical against the government? I think one of the concerns I have is the way that our government is really becoming more authoritarian. They are trying to impeach the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. You know, they have imprisoned a senator who has been very vocal against the president. And then the media is also being controlled. So if this is the kind of situation, then of course we have to really express our resistance against this development that's happening within our country. I think we have to save, you know, the democratic institutions and democracy within the Philippines.
Ms. Tauli Corpus, thank you so much for speaking to us. You said that these particular charges against you are the most serious thing that has happened to you as an indigenous activist. Mm. You've been fighting since you were 12. Mm. You're a grandmother
yes,
now.
Don't,
aren't
eight.
You, of eight?
Yes.
Of eight. Congratulations. Don't you ever get tired? Don't you ever say, you know what, I've done my part, I've fought, let somebody else take over now?
Well, not really. It's like I have embraced this as the reason for being, you know, as the reason for being, you know. I think that as long as the indigenous people's rights are continually violated, I think it's my duty and I'm compelled to still speak out. Of course, now it's a good thing because I'm the special rapporteur. But even after my post as a rapporteur, it's like this is the reason for me to be here, I guess, you know, to be able to help make visible the issues as well as to continue to do whatever I can to protect the rights of indigenous peoples and to convince governments that indigenous peoples are not the enemies. They are the allies of governments, because we are the ones who are protecting many of the world's remaining ecosystems. And if they allow us and they give us the rights to do that, then we will be contributing to the problems of the world. So that's my passion, to be able to really continue doing this work, making it visible and convincing governors as well as corporations that it's the right thing to do.
Thank you so much. Okay. And prior to the interview, you and I were talking and we were reminiscing about before you were special rapporteur, that you were the chairperson of the Permanent Forum. And you, I think you did an incantation or a song from the Cordillera region.
Yeah.
Would you mind doing that again?
That said, okay, yeah. Okay, I'll do that. Dangdang ay sidung ilay in sinali duma ay alilalay dumiwa salidumay.
And thank you so much. And remind us what it's about.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane. Thanks
thank
for having me.
And the song, what is it about? Sorry.
Yeah, well, it's a chant. It's a chant that we sing whenever we have like rituals when we come together. So it's like just a chant to say that we should stay united. We should all work together, and we should maintain our community and the relationships that we have with our land. So it's a chant that we sing to confirm and affirm that is what we are all about.
Victoria Tauli Corpus from the Philippines is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. As we record this podcast, she's on an official visit to Guatemala to examine issues concerning the country's indigenous communities, such as land tenure, racial discrimination, and access to justice. I'm Deanne Penn. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of our UN Gender Focus podcast from UN News.